Don Juan was not at his house when I arrived there at midday on November 8, 1968. I had no idea where to look for him, so I sat and waited. For some unknown reason, I knew he would soon be home. A short while later, Don Juan walked into his house. He nodded at me. We exchanged greetings. He seemed to be tired and lay down on his mat. He yawned a couple of times. The idea of seeing had become an obsession with me, and I had made up my mind to use his hallucinogenic smoking mixture again. It had been a terribly difficult decision to make, so I still wanted to argue the point a bit further. "I want to learn to see, Don Juan," I said bluntly, "but I really don't want to take anything. I don't want to smoke your mixture. Do you think there is any chance I could learn to see without it?" He sat up, stared at me for a moment, and lay down again. "No," he said. "You'll have to use the smoke. Seeing is not so simple, and only the smoke can give you the speed you need to catch a glimpse of that fleeting world. Otherwise, you will only look." The next day, November 9th, Don Juan let me eat only a morsel of food and told me to rest. I lay around all morning, but I could not relax. I had no idea what Don Juan had in mind, but worst of all, I was not certain what I had in mind myself. "You haven't prepared your mixture for 3 years," he said suddenly. "You'll have to smoke my mixture. So let's say that I have collected it for you. You'll need only a bit of it. I will fill the pipe's bowl once. You will smoke all of it and then rest. Then the keeper of the other world will come. You will do nothing but observe it. Observe how it moves. Observe everything it does. Your life may depend on how well you watch." Don Juan flatly refused to involve himself in conversation, but I was too nervous to stop talking, and I insisted desperately that he tell me about this guardian. "You'll see it," he said casually. "It guards the other world." With that, Don Juan went inside the house. I followed him into his room. "Wait, wait, Don Juan, what are you going to do?" He did not answer. He took his pipe out of a bundle and sat down on a straw mat in the center of the room, looking at me inquisitively. He seemed to be waiting for my consent. "You're a fool," he said softly. "You're not afraid. You just say you're afraid." He shook his head slowly from side to side. Then he took the little bag with the smoking mixture and filled the pipe bowl. "I am afraid, Don Juan. I'm really afraid." "No, it's not fear." I paced up and down the room in front of Don Juan, who was still sitting on his mat, holding his pipe and looking at me inquisitively. And upon considering the matter, I arrived at the conclusion that what I felt, instead of my usual fear, was a profound sense of displeasure, a discomfort at the mere thought of the confusion created by the intake of hallucinogenic plants. Don Juan stared at me for an instant, then he looked past me, squinting as if he were struggling to detect something in the distance. I kept walking back and forth in front of him until he forcefully told me to sit down and relax. We sat quietly for a few minutes. "You don't want to lose your clarity, do you?" he said abruptly. "That's very right, Don Juan," I said. He laughed with apparent delight. "Clarity, the second enemy of a man of knowledge, has loomed upon you." "You're not afraid," he said reassuringly, "but now you hate to lose your clarity. And since you're a fool, you call that fear." He chuckled. "Get me some charcoals," he ordered. His tone was kind and reassuring. I got up automatically and went to the back of the house and gathered some small pieces of burning charcoal from the fire, put them on top of a small stone slab, and returned to the room. "Come out here to the porch," Don Juan called loudly from outside. He placed a straw mat on the spot where I usually sit. I put the charcoals next to him, and he blew on them to activate the fire. I was about to sit down, but he stopped me and told me to sit on the right edge of the mat. He then put a piece of charcoal in the pipe and handed it to me. I took it. I was amazed at the silent forcefulness with which Don Juan had steered me. I could not think of anything to say. I had no more arguments. I was convinced that I was not afraid, but only unwilling to lose my clarity. "Puff, puff," he ordered me gently. "Just one bowl this time." I sucked on the pipe and heard the chirping of the mixture catching on fire. I felt an instantaneous coat of ice inside my mouth and my nose. I took another puff and the coating extended to my chest. When I had taken the last puff, I felt that the entire inside of my body was coated with a peculiar sensation of cold warmth. Don Juan took the pipe away from me and tapped the bowl on his palm to loosen the residue. Then, as he always does, he wet his finger with saliva and rubbed it inside the bowl. My body was numb, but I could move. I changed positions to sit more comfortably. "What's going to happen?" I asked. I had some difficulty vocalizing. Don Juan very carefully put his pipe inside its sheath and rolled it up in a long piece of cloth. Then he sat up straight, facing me. I felt dizzy. My eyes were closing involuntarily. Don Juan shook me vigorously and ordered me to stay awake. He said I knew very well that if I fell asleep, I would die. That jolted me. It occurred to me that Don Juan was probably just saying that to keep me awake, but on the other hand, it also occurred to me that he might be right. I opened my eyes as wide as I could, and that made Don Juan laugh. He said that I had to wait for a while and keep my eyes open all the time, and that at a given moment, I would be able to see the guardian of the other world. I felt a very annoying heat all over my body. I tried to change position, but I could not move anymore. I wanted to talk to Don Juan. The words seemed to be so deep inside of me that I could not bring them out. Then I tumbled on my left side and found myself looking at Don Juan from the floor. He leaned over and ordered me in a whisper not to look at him, but to stare fixedly at a point on my mat which was directly in front of my eyes. He said that I had to look with one eye, my left eye, and that sooner or later I would see the guardian. I fixed my stare on the spot he had pointed to, but I did not see anything. At a certain moment, however, I noticed a gnat flying in front of my eyes. It landed on the mat. I followed its movements. It came very close to me, so close that my visual perception blurred. And then, all of a sudden, I felt as if I had stood up. It was a very puzzling sensation that deserved some pondering, but there was no time for that. I had the total sensation that I was looking straight onward from my usual eye level, and what I saw shook up the last fiber of my being. There is no other way to describe the emotional jolt I experienced. Right there, facing me a short distance away, was a gigantic, monstrous animal, a truly monstrous thing. Never in the wildest fantasies of fiction had I encountered anything like it. I looked at it in complete, utmost bewilderment. The first thing I really noticed was its size. I thought for some reason it must be close to 100 feet tall. It seemed to be standing erect, although I could not figure out how it stood. Next, I noticed that it had wings, two short, wide wings. At that point, I became aware that I insisted on examining the animal as if it were an ordinary sight. That is, I looked at it. However, I could not really look at it in the way I was accustomed to looking. I realized that I was rather noticing things about it, as if the picture were becoming more clear as parts were added. Its body was covered with tufts of black hair. It had a long muzzle and was drooling. Its eyes were bulgy and round, like two enormous white balls. Then it began to beat its wings. It was not the flapping motion of a bird's wings, but a kind of flickering, vibratory tremor. It gained speed and began circling in front of me. It was not flying, but rather skidding with astonishing speed and agility just a few inches above the ground. For a moment, I found myself engrossed in watching it move. I thought that its movements were ugly, and yet its speed and easiness were superb. It circled twice in front of me, vibrating its wings, and whatever was drooling out of its mouth flew in all directions. Then it turned around and skidded away at an incredible speed until it disappeared in the distance. I stared fixedly in the direction it had gone because there was nothing else I could do. I had a most peculiar sensation of being incapable of organizing my thoughts coherently. I could not move away. It was as if I were glued to the spot. Then I saw something like a cloud in the distance. An instant later, the gigantic beast was circling again at full speed in front of me. Its wings cut closer and closer to my eyes until they hit me. I felt that its wings had actually hit whatever part of me was there. I yelled with all my might in the midst of one of the most excruciating pains I have ever had. The next thing I knew, I was seated on my mat, and Don Juan was rubbing my forehead. He rubbed my arms and legs with leaves, then he took me to an irrigation ditch behind his house, took off my clothes and submerged me completely, then pulled me out and submerged me over and over again. As I lay on the shallow bottom of the irrigation ditch, Don Juan pulled up my left foot from time to time and tapped the sole gently. After a while, I felt a ticklishness. He noticed it and said that I was all right. I put on my clothes and we returned to his house. I sat down again on my straw mat and tried to talk, but I felt I could not concentrate on what I wanted to say, although my thoughts were very clear. I was amazed to realize how much concentration was necessary to talk. I also noticed that in order to say something, I had to stop looking at things. I had the impression that I was entangled at a very deep level, and when I wanted to talk, I had to surface like a diver. I had to ascend as if pulled by my words. Twice I went as far as clearing my throat in a fashion which was perfectly ordinary. I could have said then whatever I wanted to, but I did not. I preferred to remain at the strange level of silence where I could just look. I had the feeling that I was beginning to tap what Don Juan had called seeing, and that made me very happy. Afterwards, Don Juan gave me some soup and tortillas and ordered me to eat. I was able to eat without any trouble and without losing what I thought to be my power of seeing. I focused my gaze on everything around me. I was convinced I could see everything, and yet the world looked the same to the best of my assessment. I struggled to see until it was quite dark. I finally got tired and lay down and went to sleep. I woke up when Don Juan covered me with a blanket. I had a headache and was sick to my stomach. After a while, I felt better and slept soundly until the next day. In the morning, I was myself again. I asked Don Juan eagerly, "What happened to me?" Don Juan laughed coyly. "You went to look for the keeper, and of course you found it," he said. November 12, 1968. This morning, Don Juan and I went to the nearby hills to collect plants. We walked about 6 miles on extremely rough terrain. I became very tired. We sat down to rest at my initiative, and he began a conversation, saying that he was pleased with my progress. Later on, we talked again about the guardian of the other world. "If I believe that whatever I have experienced is actually real," I said, "then the guardian is a gigantic creature that can cause unbelievable physical pain. And if I believe that one can actually travel enormous distances by an act of will, then it's logical to conclude that I could also will the monster to disappear. Is that correct?" "Not exactly," he said. "You cannot will the guardian to disappear. Your will can stop it from harming you, though. Of course, if you ever accomplish that, the road is open to you. You can actually go by the guardian, and there's nothing that it can do, not even whirl around madly." "How can I accomplish that?" "You already know how. All you need now is practice." I told him that we were having a misunderstanding that stemmed from our differences in perceiving the world. "You really know how to talk and say nothing, don't you?" he said, laughing. "I've told you, you have to have an unbending intent in order to become a man of knowledge. But you seem to have an unbending intent to confuse yourself with riddles. You insist on explaining everything as if the whole world were composed of things that can be explained. Now you are confronted with the guardian and with the problem of moving by using your will. Has it ever occurred to you that only a few things in this world can be explained your way? When I say that the guardian is really blocking your passing and could actually knock the devil out of you, I know what I mean. When I say that one can move by one's will, I also know what I mean." Don Juan asked me abruptly if I was planning to leave for home during the weekend. I said I intended to leave Monday morning. We were sitting under his ramada around midday on Saturday, January 18, 1969, taking a rest after a long walk in the nearby hills. Don Juan got up and went into the house. A few moments later, he called me inside. He was sitting in the middle of his room and had placed my straw mat in front of his. He motioned me to sit down, and without saying a word, he unwrapped his pipe, took it out of its sheath, filled its bowl with his smoking mixture, and lit it. He had even brought into his room a clay tray filled with small charcoals. He did not ask me whether I was willing to smoke. He just handed me the pipe and told me to puff. I did not hesitate. Don Juan had apparently assessed my mood correctly. My overwhelming curiosity about the guardian must have been obvious to him. I did not need any coaxing and eagerly smoked the entire bowl. Don Juan lay down on his side facing me. I felt very content. "It's nice," I said. Don Juan got up hurriedly. "Don't you dare start with this crap," he said forcefully. "Don't talk. You'll waste every bit of energy talking, and then the guardian will mash you down like you would smash a gnat." He must have thought that his simile was funny because he began to laugh, but he stopped suddenly. "Don't talk. Please, don't talk," he said with a serious look on his face. "I wasn't about to say anything," I said, "and I really did not want to say that." Don Juan got up. I saw him walking away toward the back of his house. A moment later, I noticed that a gnat had landed on my mat, and that filled me with a kind of anxiety I had never experienced before. It was a mixture of elation, anguish, and fear. I was totally aware that something transcendental was about to unfold in front of me. A gnat who guarded the other world. It was a ludicrous thought. I felt like laughing out loud. But then I realized that my elation was distracting me, and I was going to miss a transition period I wanted to clarify. In my previous attempt to see the guardian, I had looked at the gnat first with my left eye, and then I felt that I had stood up and looked at it with both eyes, but I was not aware how that transition had occurred. I saw the gnat whirling around on the mat in front of my face and realized that I was looking at it with both eyes. It came very close. At a given moment, I could not see it with both eyes any longer and shifted the view to my left eye, which was level with the ground. The instant I changed focus, I also felt that I had straightened my body to a fully vertical position and I was looking at an unbelievably enormous animal. It was brilliantly black. Its front was covered with long, black, insidious hair, which looked like spikes coming through the cracks of some slick, shiny scales. The hair was actually arranged in tufts. Its body was massive, thick and round. Its wings were wide and short in comparison to the length of its body. It had two white, bulging eyes and a long muzzle. This time it looked more like an alligator. It seemed to have long ears or perhaps horns, and it was drooling. I strained myself to fix my gaze on it and then became fully aware that I could not look at it in the same way I ordinarily look at things. I had a strange thought. Looking at the Guardian's body, I felt that every single part of it was independently alive, as the eyes of men are alive. I realized then for the first time in my life that the eyes were the only part of a man that could show to me whether or not he was alive. The Guardian, on the other hand, had a million eyes. I thought this was a remarkable finding. Before this experience, I had speculated on the similes that could describe the distortions that rendered a gnat as a gigantic beast, and I had thought that a good simile was as if looking at an insect through the magnifying lens of a microscope. But that was not so. Apparently, viewing the Guardian was much more complex than looking at a magnified insect. The Guardian began to whirl in front of me. At one moment it stopped, and I felt it was looking at me. I noticed then that it made no sound. The dance of the Guardian was silent. The awesomeness was in its appearance, its bulging eyes, its horrendous mouth, its drooling, its insidious hair, and above all, its incredible size. I watched very closely the way it moved its wings, how it made them vibrate without sound. I watched how it skidded over the ground like a monumental ice skater. Looking at that nightmarish creature in front of me, I actually felt elated. I really believed I had discovered the secret of overpowering it. I thought the Guardian was only a moving picture on a silent screen. It could not harm me. It only looked terrifying. The Guardian was standing still, facing me. Suddenly it fluttered its wings and turned around. Its back looked like brilliantly colored armor. Its shine was dazzling, but the hue was nauseating. It was my unfavorable color. The Guardian remained with its back turned to me for a while, and then, fluttering its wings, again skidded out of sight. I was confronted with a very strange dilemma. I honestly believed that I had overpowered it by realizing that it presented only a picture of wrath. My belief was perhaps due to Don Juan's insistence that I knew more than I was willing to admit. At any rate, I felt I had overcome the Guardian and the path was free, yet I did not know how to proceed. Don Juan had not told me what to do in such a case. I tried to turn and look behind me, but I was unable to move. However, I could see very well over the major part of a 180-degree range in front of my eyes. And what I saw was a cloudy, pale yellow horizon. It seemed gaseous. A sort of lemon hue uniformly covered all I could see. It seemed that I was on a plateau filled with vapors of sulfur. Suddenly, the Guardian appeared again at a point on the horizon. It made a wide circle before stopping in front of me. Its mouth was wide open like a huge cavern. It had no teeth. It vibrated its wings for an instant, and then it charged at me. It actually charged at me like a bull, and with its gigantic wings, it swung at my eyes. I screamed with pain, and then I flew up, or rather, I felt I had ejected myself up and went soaring beyond the Guardian, beyond the yellowish plateau, into another world, the world of men, and I found myself standing in the middle of Don Juan's room. January 19th, 1969. I really thought I had overpowered the Guardian, I said to Don Juan. You must be kidding, he said. You must not try to see the Guardian ever again. It's not your temperament to cross that plane. Yet I was convinced that you could go through it. But let's not talk about it anymore. This was only one of a variety of roads. For 3 months, Don Juan systematically avoided talking about the Guardian. I paid him 4 visits during these months. He involved me in running errands for him every time, and when I had performed the errands, he simply told me to go home. On April 24th, 1969, the fourth time I was at his house, I finally confronted him after we had eaten dinner and were sitting next to his earthen stove. How did I fail, Don Juan? You think about everything. You thought about the Guardian, and thus you couldn't overcome it. First, you must live like a warrior. I think you understand that very well. I wanted to interject something in my defense, but he gestured with his hand to be quiet. Your life is fairly tight. You faithfully carried out everything I've told you to do. Everything that my benefactor taught me in the first stage of learning I have passed on to you. The rule is right. The steps cannot be changed. You've done everything one has to do, and yet you don't see. But to those who see, like Gennaro, you appear as though you see. I rely on that, and I'm fooled. You always turn around and behave like an idiot who doesn't see, which of course is right for you. Don Juan's words distressed me profoundly. I don't know why, but I was close to tears. I began to talk about my childhood, and a wave of self-pity enveloped me. Don Juan stared at me for a brief moment and then moved his eyes away. It was a penetrating glance. Then he steered the conversation to my childhood. Why was your childhood sad? He asked with a serious expression. I told him that my childhood had not really been sad, but perhaps a bit difficult. Everybody feels that way, he said, looking at me again. I too was very unhappy and afraid when I was a child. To be an Indian is hard, very hard. But the memory of that time no longer has meaning for me beyond that it was hard. I had ceased to think about the hardship of my life even before I had learned to see. I was a skinny child, he went on, and I was always afraid. So was I said. What I remember the most is the terror and sadness that fell upon me when the Mexican soldiers killed my mother, he said softly, as if the memory was still painful. Perhaps it was better that her life was over then. I wanted to be killed with her because I was a child. But the soldiers picked me up and beat me. When I grabbed onto my mother's body, they hit my fingers with a horsewhip and broke them. I didn't feel any pain, but I couldn't grasp anymore. And then they dragged me away. He stopped talking. His eyes were still closed, and I could detect a very slight tremor in his lips. A profound sadness began to overtake me. Images of my own childhood started to flood my mind. That was the time of the great Yaqui Wars. The Mexican soldiers came upon us unexpectedly while my mother was cooking some food. She was a helpless woman. They killed her for no reason at all. It doesn't make any difference that she died that way. Not really. And yet for me, it does. I cannot tell myself why, though. It just does. I thought they had killed my father, too, but they hadn't. He was wounded. Later on, they put us in a train like cattle and closed the door. For days, they kept us there in the dark like animals. They kept us alive with bits of food they threw into the wagon from time to time. My father died of his wounds in that wagon. He became delirious with pain and fever and went on telling me that I had to survive. He kept on telling me that until the very last moment of his life. The people took care of me. They gave me food. An old woman curer fixed the broken bones of my hand. And as you can see, I live. Life has been neither good nor bad to me. Life has been hard. Life is hard. And for a child, it is sometimes horror itself. In an instant, my feelings of empathy for Don Juan gave way to a sensation of disgust with myself. I had actually taken notes, as if Don Juan's life were merely a clinical case. I was on the verge of ripping up my notes when Don Juan poked my calf with his toe to attract my attention. He said he was seeing a light of violence around me and wondered whether I was going to start beating him. His laughter was a delightful break. He said that I was given to outbursts of violent behavior, but that I was not really mean, and that most of the time the violence was against myself. You're right, Don Juan, I said. Of course, he said, laughing. I promised my father that I would live to destroy his assassins. I carried that promise with me for years. Now the promise has changed. I'm no longer interested in destroying anybody. Today, I feel sad. Not because my mother and father died the way they did. I feel sad because they were Indians. They lived like Indians and died like Indians and never knew that they were before anything else. Men.